Silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We'll call our third case for today, 01-0081 and 82, in the interest of Lindsay A.F., State v. Lindsay. We have appearing before us Assistant Attorney General Sally L. Wellman, who will argue on behalf of the state.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. I am Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, arguing on behalf of the state, which is the appellant petitioner in this case. If one reads the record in this case, you can have the perception that this case is about an arm wrestling match or a power struggle or a control issue between a prosecutor and a judge who both feel very strongly that they believe that a certain route to go in the juvenile justice system is the best for a particular child, juvenile, and the public. But that's not all this case is about. The Court of Appeals decision brings to light a very difficult statutory construction issue, and one in which we think the Court erred. So I'd like to start with that issue, which is the interpretation of the interaction of three statutes. The first statute incorporates one by reference, and then that statute incorporates another by reference. And we believe that the Court of Appeals erred when it interpreted how those three work together. The primary issue, as we see it in this case, is whether under the provisions of the Juvenile Justice Code, the district attorney can terminate a deferred prosecution agreement that has been entered into by the intake worker, the juvenile, and the juvenile's parent, by filing a delinquency petition if the deferred prosecution agreement was initiated by the juvenile court's dismissal of a delinquency petition and referring of the matter back to the intake worker for deferred prosecution. The first statute we look at is 938.21 sub 7, which provides that if the judge or juvenile court commissioner determines it's in the best interest of the juvenile and the public, it determines that the best interests of the juvenile and the public are served, he or she may enter a consent decree or order the petition dismissed and refer the matter to the intake worker for deferred prosecution in accordance with 938.245. If we look at 938.245, that's an entire lengthy statute on deferred prosecutions and what they contain, who has to agree, a very broad range of terms and conditions, counseling and alcohol, drug assessment, treatment, going to school, working, restitution, all kinds of terms and conditions that can be applied. 938.21.7 incorporates 938.245 by reference, which we know is a basic principle of statutory construction, means that thereafter you read 938.21 sub 7 as if 938.245 were all written in there. It's just a shorthand way to save all that typing and computerizing now, I guess, and paper, that you don't have to actually repeat all the words, but it's as if those words were all explicitly brought into the first statute. Now, if we look at 938.245, the provision at issue here is sub 6, which states, a deferred prosecution agreement arising out of an alleged delinquent act, which is what we have here, is terminated if the district attorney files a delinquency petition within 20 days after receipt of notice of the deferred prosecution agreement under 938.24 sub 5. So now this statute incorporates by reference a subsection of a different section, 938.24 sub 5. So we have to bring that statute into it. So we're reading all three of them together now. And 938.24 sub 5 talks about what happens when the intake worker first gets the referral or the police report information from the police and the options that intake worker has. But what it says that's relevant to this case is if the case is closed or a deferred prosecution agreement is entered into, then the district attorney or one of the other officials enumerated shall receive written notice of such action. It provides what the notice shall contain, and then it says, notwithstanding the requirements of this section, the district attorney may initiate a delinquency petition under 93825, the petition part, within 20 days after notice that the case has been closed or a deferred prosecution agreement has been entered into. Now, what the Court of Appeals did here is basically read 93821 sub 7 as if it says the court may dismiss the petition and refer the matter to the intake worker for a deferred prosecution in accordance with 938.245, except sub 6 doesn't apply. I mean, they weren't that direct about it, but in essence, that's what the court did, because when it looked at 93824 sub 5, it said, well, that refers to what the intake worker is doing from the very front end and from the get-go. There's been no petition yet. So that notice part can't apply here. And it said 93821 sub 7 didn't reference 93824 sub 5. It only referenced 938.245. Therefore, we're going to act as if 93824.5 doesn't apply.
Ms. Wellman, do you think these statutes, when they're read in conjunction with each other, are ambiguous?
I think they're ambiguous because you have to read them all and fit them in together to make them work together.
Do we then look at legislative history?
You can. Unfortunately, there doesn't appear to be any that's helpful in this case as far as the parties were able to find.
You started out by indicating that we shouldn't look at this as a turf battle or a tug of war between the judge and the district attorney. Why shouldn't we look at it that way? Isn't that really what was going on here?
Well, I think it may have, at some times in some of the hearings, appeared to disintegrate to that level. But I think what really is going on is, what did the legislature intend when it created this separate option or this other way, alternative way of having a deferred prosecution agreement entered into?
Well, is there any indication that the legislature intended to have the juvenile court judge play a major role in the decisions involving the juvenile?
Well, certainly at the dispositional stage, the judge plays a very major role, in fact, a controlling role. And the judge can play a very major role in a consent decree. In this case, there was no consent decree, and a consent decree does require the agreement of the district attorney. So while we've moved away from an old system in which the judge basically was the be-all and end-all of the juvenile system, and while that may have worked when the judge was truly kindly and making decisions that were in the best interest of the juvenile, it didn't give the juvenile any due process. So we've moved away from that, but there certainly is our distinct and to some extent overlapping roles of the intake worker, the social services person, the prosecutor, and the judge. And on the front end, they all have some input and some say into whether this case is one that really needs to go the formal route of delinquency petition and adjudication, or is diverting it to a less formal route appropriate depending on the nature of the underlying delinquent act, the child's family, the support system, and a whole bunch of other factors. But what's important here is that at that early stage, you have the intake worker who, if it comes in under 93824, has the first crack at it, looks at the police reports, makes a layperson's decision as to whether it's a, you know, it can be prosecuted, whether there are facts that allege a crime has been committed if it were an adult, and looks at whether it should even go on to the district attorney or not, or should it just be closed or a deferred prosecution agreement entered. There can be a deferred prosecution agreement at that point. The prosecutor is not involved and doesn't have to agree. It's only between the intake worker, the juvenile, and the juvenile's parent. But then the district attorney gets notice of that after it's been entered into and has 20 days to say, no, I don't think this is appropriate. We're going to go with a delinquency petition.
Counsel,
yes.
I'm sorry.
Have you finished the answer?
I think so. I think I went off on another tangent.
I interrupt you. I want to continue that question regarding turf battle. As a circuit court judge sitting on juvenile cases, I had my experience way too often be well-meaning, good people seem to be way too often dropping the ball, whether it be social services, and again, good people, but maybe the press of caseload, heaven knows why. And the same thing in the DA's office. And I found myself oftentimes holding social services and the DA's office just as accountable as I would the juvenile, because all of them were dropping the ball at different times. Mm-hmm. Your interpretation would tie my hands. And so I have a concern about that. I mean, I would be on everyone's tail, oftentimes, much to the dismay of everyone, I'm sure. Can you respond to that? Because I understand, you know, your argument, and I look at the statute, and I look at the placement where it is with regard to custody, and the title and all this sort of stuff, but I just find it hard in this turf battle to have a circuit court limited. Can you respond to my concerns?
Yes, under the first argument, if you interpret the statute to only apply to children, juveniles in custody, then it would eliminate one option for the juvenile court. I think from the standpoint, however, of your underlying concern of somebody somewhere along the line dropping the ball, the big risk here is that if we don't let the prosecutor file a delinquency petition after notice of the deferred prosecution agreement under 938.21(7), then we have a huge black hole that kids and families and cases can fall through, because the statutes, the Court of Appeals case referring to the court ordering a deferred prosecution agreement, but that's not what the statute does. It says the court can dismiss the petition, so the petition's off the radar screen, and refer it back to the intake worker for deferred prosecution. There's no statute that requires the intake worker to come back to anyone and say, yes, we followed through, we actually did this, and here are the conditions. It just can go into outer space unless you read the requirement of 938.24(5) in of written notice to the DA. And it's very possible, didn't happen in this case, but I can see certainly in a busy county how it could happen that that doesn't get followed through on. And then you've got a kid who's getting no services, no follow-through, no efforts for accountability. Now, what this does do is say, no, the prosecutor then, once he's looked at the actual terms and conditions, and that's important language, too, that I don't think the Court of Appeals gave enough thought to. It isn't just notice that there's going to be a deferred prosecution, or notice that the court is sending it back to intake for deferred prosecution. It's notice that a deferred prosecution agreement has been entered into. That means under 938.245, it has to be in writing. All the conditions, terms have to be spelled out. Who has to do what? Do you have to go to school? Do you have to do drug testing? Do you have to get counseling? Does mom have to do this? Do you want to do safe at home? Do you do this teen for all kinds of programs? And the parents and child are also put on notice that if they have trouble complying with something, or they get into it and something's too onerous and they want to come back and re-talk to the intake worker, there's a process for doing all that. If we don't have that at all, then this is the one place in a statute that's full of checks and balances, the one place where the intake worker ends up having unreviewable, unfettered total discretion.
Well, counsel, in this particular case, was the prosecutor objecting to any of the conditions of deferred prosecution, or was the prosecutor not saying, I don't agree with what you did, Judge, in dismissing, so I'm going to file again.
I don't recall the prosecutor ever talking about any specific condition or term that he thought was inadequate or inappropriate, but he definitely thought that a deferred prosecution was not adequate under the circumstances of this case to provide services and rehabilitation to the juvenile and protect the public.
So he really was taking issue with the determination by the judge that the judge felt that deferred prosecution was the way to go. I mean, why he filed?
Yes. But it also is the only way that anyone is going to have any oversight of the precise terms and conditions.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, just looking at 38.217, deferred prosecution, and then remembering that we had the Hesse case here, and it seems to me in the Hesse that, we had the language that the juvenile court's authority to dismiss petitions under 938.21 to distinguish the juvenile justice code from the criminal code. Are you saying that we would have to overrule the language of Hesse that supports the fact that juvenile courts have the authority to dismiss a petition and refer it for deferred prosecution? That's the argument I know that your opposing counsel makes.
If you agree with us that 938.21 sub 7 only applies to juveniles in custody, then you probably need to go back and modify Hesse R to make that clear, because it doesn't speak one way or the other, and the case itself, I don't believe, ever says whether any of those juveniles were in custody. If you don't buy that argument, and you say, no, a court can do this in either case, we're not going to tie the court's hands, it can be in custody or out of custody, but the district attorney can come back and refile, then you really wouldn't have to modify Hesse R because it does say what it says. The court can dismiss and refer it back. It just doesn't say what can or cannot happen after that. And it's certainly not uncommon in a case like Hesse R, which involved totally different provisions and a totally different legal issue, that you look at a big statute and, you make a comment about what on its face and is not at issue appears to provide. It's not wrong necessarily in that context. It just doesn't go to the question that comes down in a later case.
Well, who checks the DA? The intake worker says consent. DA says no. Right?
Right.
DA comes in with a petition, delinquency petition. The court says no, deferred prosecution, because that doesn't need, at least it's arguable, doesn't need the DA's consent. So in the court, you've got review of the court on an appellate level, two appellate levels. Who checks the DA? In this checks and balances in the mm-hmm. case situation we have here, you're saying the intake worker will now have no check because the court is out of it. But who checks the DA?
Well, I think the DA is checked in a couple of ways. I think one thing is that when the court does dismiss and refer back, I think that's intended in part to cause the DA to go back and look at it again and think, okay, I didn't want a consent decree, but now the court has a different view of this. I should look at this again. Now, he might still reach the decision to file a delinquency petition.
Well, he obviously did in this case.
He did in this case. Obviously, the court is a check in the ultimate sense of at disposition, what kind of disposition to impose. And, in fact, some dispositions may be not much more or not as much in terms of terms and conditions and consequences as a consent decree or deferred prosecution agreement. Ultimately, it's the public, I think, that checks the DA. And while the proceedings themselves are closed and there's much more privacy and confidentiality, the big picture of what do the DA's offices routinely do, go too far just because it's a drug case? Do they have airtight rule and they never look at the individual case? Those kinds of things I think could be discussed in an election and an opposing candidate, and the same way you do with prosecutors who are running for public office
How do we find that out about the DA in these closed juvenile cases?
Well, my understanding of the confidentiality provisions is that although you cannot reveal the names of the individuals, certainly statistics about how many cases involving this kind of offense came in, how many did the DA file a delinquency petition, how many did the DA ask for the highest level of incarceration or confinement, those kinds of things I think can be public.
But how many kids fall through the cracks before those kind of statistics historically are collected? Am I making myself clear? I'm concerned that ultimately the public being able to vote the DA out of office based on compiling statistics in juvenile court after a period of time is an inadequate remedy to either save kids or address their needs.
It certainly isn't a perfect remedy, but I think in the long run, if you look at the total package and the options the court does have in imposing disposition, that certainly can act as a check on what one might perceive as an overzealous DA. Now, I certainly don't think that DA in this case was overzealous. I think it was entirely appropriate to do a delinquency petition when you had a 13-year-old selling drugs on the property of a middle school. But obviously, reasonable people can disagree about that. And so I think the ultimate question here is when reasonable people disagree, is the trial court at that front-end level where you don't have the deferred prosecution agreement yet? You have a defense counsel in court asking the court to dismiss a delinquency petition that the district attorney has already made, exercised his discretion and made a decision to file. And the defense is saying, we want you to refer it back to deferred prosecution. The kid and the parent will cooperate. That's all the judge knows at that time. And I'm sure those statements are made in good faith. The defense counsel believes that the juvenile and the parent will cooperate. But that's a far cry from what do we actually have on paper these people willing to do? How does this fit into the big picture? Are we concerned about other juveniles who are selling drugs on middle school property at the age of 13? You know, this is a more serious problem in one reasonable person's view than the other. And I think the legislature says we're going to give that final call on whether to go a formal delinquency petition to the DA. We're going to give the judge input by allowing dismissal and refer back. And it may be that in some cases, once it's referred back, the prosecutor says, okay, wasn't my judgment call, wouldn't be my first choice, but I can live with this.
Ordinarily, are you done?
Yes.
Ordinarily, the judge has control over dismissal cases, right?
At some stages, yes.
All right. Now, is there a separation of powers issue here when the judge can't dismiss, in effect, without the consent of the DA? Because you could say, well, the judge can dismiss, but if I understand the state's position, the DA can just come right on back and refile. So you can have this continual battle of turf, unless this court says, judge, you get one dismissal, DA, you get two files. So DA, you have ultimate control. Is there something about this that raises in me a separation of powers doctrine, that the court has jurisdiction over dismissal, and this takes it away from the court?
I have to say, I had not thought about that aspect of separation of powers. I have two initial responses. The first is that I'm not sure the court has the power of dismissal except as delegated by statute. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we do have a lot of statutes in the criminal law that say you can only dismiss with the court's approval at certain stages in these statutes. If there were not those statutes, except for legal grounds, that there's no cause of action here, or you don't have sufficient facts to establish probable cause, which I think would be obviously a separate issue. But if it's just on a what's the best way to proceed discretionary level, I don't see that as a separation of powers problem.
Well, isn't it a decision on the merits, in effect? If the judge dismisses this, it's on the merits.
Well, it's not on the merits of whether the child committed an act, which, if committed by an adult, would be a crime. It's a decision on — it's sort of a pre-trial, pre-adjudication disposition decision, in the sense that it's saying we think the best route would serve the public and the juvenile is to not have a formal adjudication and, you know, to do this diversion. So it's not on the merits of the underlying criminal conduct.
Well, you have to say that if you're going to allow the DA to bring it again. You have to say it's not on the merits. Because it's on its merits, you're bringing a second case on the same issues. And I'm not raising double jeopardy or that. But in effect, I think that the result here is if you hold that the trial judge has this power, it is a decision on the merits. The DA does not bring it back. I'm suggesting this. And that then what you have left is what your parade of horribles is that it's all in the intake worker and there's no more review.
Well, I think if you're going to say that, then you have to, with all due respect, to the Court of Appeals, I think you have to have a better explanation for how we know that's what the legislature intended when it wrote in accordance with 938245, and sub 6 specifically says you can do that, except this obscure going back to the notice requirement and saying, well, notice doesn't apply because the rest of the statute is in a different context. It seems to me, I can see how a legislature might choose to do it either way. But if they did not want the prosecutor to be able to refile in this situation, I can't imagine why they didn't just say 938245 except sub 6.
Well, one of the things is you have a combination of old Chapter 48 brought into 938, and then you've got a major revision of 938 in 94-95 time period, which then tries to meld in all of this. And it's not unheard of that the meld wasn't carefully enough done.
Well, and certainly, I mean, I don't know that the melding of the statutes in this case caused some problems. I think the language is pretty much there. But I do think that when you write a statute this big and this long, covering so many different situations, that there, you know, there often may be places where it's not a tight fit. For example, I was surprised to see in 938245 sub 8, where it talks about if the juvenile and the family both comply with all the requirements and the intake worker decides that, you know, they've done good and it's achieved its goals and it should be ended, and she informs the juvenile and the parent that you've complied and you cannot be prosecuted now for this underlying offense. It doesn't say you tell the DA that. I mean, it just seems so logical. Who else should you tell but the office that would bring a prosecution? They need to know, did this ultimately work out or not?
And, of course, here it didn't work out.
Exactly.
And so the DA was notified, and then we were back in court, I guess.
Right, right. The child did violate.
So if there's a violation, you do get review.
Well, except that the prosecutor only knows about that if the intake worker comes back and tells him.
All right.
Thank you.
Could I ask you,
Justice Prosser,
What, if any, is the relationship between 938217 and the waiver statute?
I don't think there is any, because once the child is waived, I don't think you any longer have the 938-28 custody hearings at all. The juvenile is from then on treated as an adult.
What I'm trying to get at is, could a judge dismiss a matter before the district attorney was able to seek waiver?
You know, I'm not sure with that. I'm not sure when the waiver petition has to be filed, if it has to be filed with the delinquency petition or if there's a lag time. I think that would control. My My recollection when I used to do more juvenile work than I do now, which is a long time ago, is that they were usually filed together. But I, off the top of my head, I don't know if the statute requires that. Sorry.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Eileen Hirsch, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Lindsay A.F.
Thank you, Justice Abramson. I may be a little unorganized today because, quite honestly, I am surprised by the state's argument. And I'll just briefly explain that and then go on and address it. But the court, the argument the state is making today is the argument that it made in the Court of Appeals. And so I can go back. I was pulling out my Court of Appeals brief and looking through that. But in the petition for review in this court, the state said that the reason it was asking for the petition for review is because it had a new and different argument that was not made in the Court of Appeals. And that argument took most of the briefing in this case. It had to do with whether the judge's authority was limited to custody hearings. It appears to me that the state is not asking the court to take that position today. And so my plan today is not to spend much time with that argument. And I would ask the court to go back to the briefs in the Court of Appeals and to the Court of Appeals decision, which squarely addressed the issue that the state is now raising in oral argument today. Now, turning to that argument, I want to suggest that the court may wonder what the state's current position is. Lindsay F. believes that both the trial court and the Court of Appeals were correct in this case, that the three statutes that the state mentioned do interrelate, but that when one works out the most harmonious construction of those statutes and one that accords with the history and the intent of the legislature, one comes to the conclusion that, first, Section 938.21, parent 7, is not ambiguous. Every judge who has considered that statute in this case has found that it is not ambiguous. Both the Court of Appeals and the trial court found that the interrelationship of Section 938.24, parents 5, and Section 938.245, parents 6, does create some ambiguity. And they resolved that ambiguity by looking at the words of the statute and the intent of the legislature. And if I can, actually, it's fairly well summarized in the Court of Appeals decision, but I can state it here. It is basically that Section 938.245, parent 6, says that a deferred prosecution agreement is terminated if the district attorney files a delinquency petition within 20 days after receipt of notice of the deferred prosecution agreement under 24, parents 5. When you turn to 24, parents 5, it is very clear that that section deals with the initial intake inquiry, the inquiry that occurs before the case ever goes to the district attorney. And as the trial court pointed out, it says in parents 5, the first sentence is, the intake worker shall request that a petition be filed, enter into a deferred prosecution agreement, or close the case within 40 days or sooner of receipt of referral information. We are way outside the timeline for receipt of referral information in this case. And so the court found that the provision that if the intake worker closes the case or enters into a deferred prosecution agreement, the provision that the district attorney shall receive written notice does not apply in the instance where we're outside the initial intake inquiry that's been finished and completed, the case has gone to the DA, and the judge has made the decision that a deferred prosecution agreement is appropriate. And so what the court found is this notice that triggers the district attorney's ability to veto a deferred prosecution agreement does not occur in the situation where the trial court has referred it back to intake for a deferred prosecution agreement. I think it is a very simple and very elegant and very correct interpretation of the statute. The state has offered no feasible alternative at this point. The state argued in the Court of Appeals that Section 938.21, parent 7, just didn't mean what it said, that it just meant nothing. The state argued in its briefs that it applied only at custody hearings. None of those hearings hold water. None of those interpretations hold water when tested against the intent and the purpose of the statute and the language of the statute. I do want to get to a couple questions the judge asked. I think Judge Crooks did hit the matter on the head when he asked if it isn't, in fact, a turf battle between the court and the district attorney. And I think that is the only way one can really think about this case. The question is, when they disagree, who makes the final decision? And my answer that is, in juvenile court, the answer is clearly the judge, for several reasons, one of which is that the long history of the juvenile court back for 100 years is that the juvenile judge actually under the old Section 4819 before 1978 had authority under Section 4819 entitled informal disposition to determine whether the court actually authorized the filing of a petition or sent it back for informal disposition under Section 4819. Now, when the Children's Code was revised and expanded greatly in 1977, the court did at that point add a new intake worker position and intake worker duties. It also added a district attorney position and gave the district attorney the authority to file petitions. However, the language of Section 4821, parent 7, is very similar to Section 4819, the old Section 4819, in three ways. First of all, they're both entitled informal disposition, pre-1977 and after 1977. 4819 was entitled informal disposition, as was 4821, parent 7. In 4819, the judge's determination was based, and this was the language of the statute, if it determines that neither the interests of the child nor of the public require that a petition be filed. Current language in Section 4821 was and now is in 93821, if the court determines that the best interests of the juvenile and the public are served. Same criteria. Same decision. Should it be handled formally or should it be handled informally? Why was it moved to Section 4821, parent 7, from Section 4819? Clear legislative process. Section 4819 now involves taking children into custody. It's law enforcement, social worker action. Section 4821, parent 7, in the old Children's Code, the after 1978 Children's Code, was the first place, Section 4821, was the first place where the judge made any decisions in a juvenile court proceeding. If you go through the chapter and you're looking for where a judge, the first place for the judge to make a decision, it's in Section 4821. So they moved that authority from 4819 to 4821, and now it's incorporated in Section 93821, parent 7. Basically the same language with a few changes for the new terminology of the code.
Ms. Hirsch, can I interrupt for a minute?
Yes.
In regard to this particular case, it's my understanding that it's really moot in regard to your client.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why should we decide this issue? Is it important that we decide it?
Well, you have a published decision of the Court of Appeals. I personally would prefer that you allowed that position to stand. I think it is the correct position. But I do think it is an issue that arises frequently. Before this case, there were two unpublished cases in the Court of Appeals, and then this case was published. Most of them come out of Dane County, but it has been up several times, and I think that a definitive decision either through the Court of Appeals or this court is important to the interests of justice.
Thank you.
Doesn't your position in the Court of Appeals position on the appropriate interpretation of 93821 sub 7 depend upon a conclusion that subsection applies across the board in juvenile matters, not just to
That's
juveniles
correct.
In custody? If that were a correct interpretation, why would the legislature have included it in 93821, which pertains to juveniles in custody, and in the subchapter of Chapter 938, subchapter 4, which contains the subsections of the chapter that pertain to juveniles in custody? If it was meant to apply across the board, why put it in there?
I think that it was put in there because it used to be in a very close section. It used to be in 4819. And when the legislature rewrote the code, this is not legislation is not an easy science. I think this law, with a change that happened in 1977, had been in the legislature for several terms and being debated. But I think what happened really is that they wanted to preserve the part of 4819 that allowed the judge to dismiss and refer back to intake. And they just simply put it at the next place that it came in the code, the next place the judge made a decision. So if you begin with 4801 and read through, the first time the judge is making a decision in juvenile court is at section 4821 of the 1977-78 code.
Well, for juveniles who are in custody.
For any juvenile, for any case. There's no decision-making authority before that. Can I just go on about, let me just expand that answer a little bit. Because the state has tried in every way to argue that this authority, it tried in the Court of Appeals to argue that this authority just simply did not exist, that this was a mistake in the code. It argues in this court that it only applies at custody hearings. That argument always falls down, however, when you test it against the real world. And the problem is that it creates an absurd result if you limit it to custody hearings. And it's this. Deferred prosecution agreements cannot place a child outside the home. They can require all kinds of conditions, all kinds of treatment. They can require restitution, all kinds of things. They cannot place the child outside the home. So it makes no sense to limit the court's authority to refer back for a deferred prosecution agreement only to those cases in which the child has been placed outside the home. It makes no sense whatsoever, because the only child who gets a custody hearing is the one who's been placed outside the home.
But this presupposes that custody is going to be terminated upon dismissal and referral.
Correct, but at the time the judge
issue.
Well, at the time the judge is making the decision, the child's been taken into custody.
I understand that, but this is a dispositional option for the judge in the case of a juvenile in custody who gets a hearing within 24 hours or potentially 48 hours on the petition that's filed. And the judge at that juncture has the option of terminating the custody, dismissing the petition, and referring
right.
for the deferred prosecution, and basically putting the juvenile back into the ordinary pipeline, if you will.
Right. And why would not the judge have the authority under a reasonable system to put the child back in that pipeline?
It makes perfect sense to me, but it doesn't make sense to me that the judge for a juvenile who originates in that pipeline should have that authority when it's not specified as a dispositional option in that subchapter.
Well, there isn't actually a subchapter for kids who are not held in custody.
There's a procedure. Subchapter 5, subchapter 6, and subchapter 7.
Subchapters 5, subchapter 6, and subchapter 7 all apply to children who are in custody, too. It applies to all children in juvenile court, including those who are in custody and those who are not in custody.
Well, then why didn't the legislature put this there if the legislature wanted it to apply to everybody?
I've given you the best reason I can. I cannot look into the minds of the legislators. But it doesn't make sense to say that only for children, that we are not going to allow the judge to make an unrelated decision. There's really two different decisions. There's a decision, does this child need to be held in custody? And that decision, by the way, is made several times during the course of a case. That decision, one of the problems with the state's brief here, if we're going to talk about this first argument, is that it presupposes that there is one custody hearing that takes place within 24 hours, and that's it. And so when that case then is dismissed and sent back to intake, you're still within the 40-hour timeline for intake. That's what it says. Unfortunately, that's not how the juvenile court works. In juvenile court, custody hearings are like bail hearings, except they happen more often than they do in criminal court. And juveniles, as I point out in my brief, if Lindsay had run away from home, she was not in custody, but if she had run away from home 2 months later, she might have been placed in shelter care and given a custody hearing. Now, does it make sense at that point that the court could dismiss and refer back to intake because it's now at a custody hearing, whereas it did not have the authority if she had behaved perfectly and not run away from home? And those are the kinds of anomalies that occur throughout the statute, because custody hearings happen at every stage of the case. They don't all happen within 24 hours.
Well, the deferred prosecution is an available option pre-charging,
that's
if you
correct.
Will, in the ordinary course of things. And as I read this, the structure of the statute, this just makes it an option in the post-charging phase for the judge in the case of a juvenile in custody. You see what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying. I agree with every part of that except for the in custody.
Because otherwise it wouldn't be an option, right?
No, it would always be an option. It would always, if
post-charging?
Post-charging. The judge doesn't deal with the case until a petition has been filed. And so what this statute allows the judge to do in every case, in my view, in the Court of Appeals' view, is to dismiss the delinquency petition and refer it back for deferred prosecution, to say that this case does not need to be a formal adjudication, and so I'm referring it back for an informal adjudication, a deferred prosecution agreement.
Whether the child is in custody or not.
Whether the child's in custody or not. And the reason is that it doesn't, it really mostly makes sense for kids who are not been taken, who have not been taken into custody. Because if a child's been taken into custody, there's a problem with custody. There's a problem with that child being in the home for some reason, the seriousness of the offense, the availability of the family, whatever it is. And a deferred prosecution agreement is almost by definition not appropriate for that child because the deferred prosecution agreement cannot include out-of-home placement.
If this interpretation is correct, it seems to me it's a complete end run around fact-finding. In other words,
no.
if it can be used as suggested by the Court of Appeals,
right,
then after a delinquency petition has been filed, the judge and the intake worker can completely end run the ordinary process of fact-finding on that delinquency petition by invoking the statute, which is contained in the subchapter of the chapter that pertains to delinquents in custody,
right,
and just avoid fact-finding altogether. And it seems to me that is quite contrary to the structure of the statute and the intent of the legislature, which I think intended, once a delinquency petition has been filed, that eventually we're going to get to fact-finding on that or some sort of an admission or a plea.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I mean, I just don't think that that is the intent of the legislature. The legislature, there is the option, there is the policy in favor of a diversion, an early diversion whenever possible. And so unlike the criminal code, there is the ability to do a consent decree and there is ability to do deferred prosecution. I think I want to address, however, an underlying issue, because I know that for those of us who have spent a great deal of time in criminal court, in some ways this is counterintuitive. Because if you think about the important criminal court cases about the judge's inherent authority to dismiss a complaint with prejudice over the objection of the district attorney, we all know that the law says the courts can't do that, that the criminal court can't do that. And those cases, I think, set up sort of this kind of intuitive sense that the judge cannot dismiss a charge over the objection of the district attorney. Again, this is addressed in the Court of Appeals briefs, but it's Brownsdorf and the cases around that. Those cases are very different from juvenile law for three reasons. Number one, every one of them had to do with the inherent authority of the court. And they specifically point out that it's inherent authority in the absence of statutory authority. This case, there's a statute, number one. Number two, each of those cases, when you read the analysis, is based on the district attorney's role at common law and in the Constitution. The juvenile court is not a common law court. It is a statutory creation, as this court has repeatedly held. And much of the Brownsdorf analysis is based on common law. Number three, constitutional law. Again, reasoning of those cases is that the district attorney is an executive officer answerable for his or her actions at the polls. And, of course, a criminal court is a public forum. The public can come in. The public can have newspaper reporters there and television news and judge the district. Can have the O.J. Simpson trial and judge the district attorney's performance in order to make a reasonable decision about whether that district attorney continues to represent the interests of the public. That cannot happen in juvenile court because it's a confidential court. And so the legislature has established that checks and balances system that Ms. Wellman referred to. And that is, instead of police reports going directly to the district attorney, as they do in adult court, they go to the intake worker makes a decision, the district attorney can check that decision, and then it seems to me to be quite obvious that the next check on that decision can be the trial court's decision, that the court can decide that this is not a case for a formal adjudication, this is a case for a deferred prosecution. If any party disagrees with that, the party can use the usual check on a judge's discretion, which is to go to the Court of Appeals. And so we have a complete set of checks and balances within the statutory framework of the Children's Court, which is very different from that that occurs in the criminal court.
What's the standard of review?
The standard review, I imagine, would be the misuse of discretion.
It's highly deferential, so
yes,
you're unlikely to get that decision undone on appeal.
And that's exactly what happens to the juvenile if the judge disagrees and denies the juvenile's motion. It's the same standard of review.
Well, no, then there's fact-finding, and if the DA has overcharged the case and can't prove it, you know, it's going to get kicked out at that stage, right?
That's a
different... Or, you know, there's a dispositional hearing, even if the facts are not bad. Mm-hmm. If, you know, if the facts are there and there's an adjudication, then there's just a myriad of dispositional options, many of which favor the juvenile.
There's I do want to mention in this case what actually happened in this case, and you can check. I don't have citations to the juvenile, the trial court record in front of me, but in this case, the district attorney, the intake worker recommended a consent decree. The district attorney disagreed, and properly representing the interests of the public, said that as a general rule, the bringing of drugs to school, no matter what the quality of those drugs, required a formal delinquency adjudication in the district attorney's view. So this was a general position on the behalf of the district attorney. Now this decision, though, was made by the juvenile court judge, and you'll see that the criteria are not the interests of the public, which is the district attorney's role, but the interests of the child and the public, which is traditionally and always in the juvenile court a weighing and balancing that is given to the judge. And clearly there was a technical legal violation, but the judge said, given the circumstances of this case, that it would be a disability for this child to have a formal adjudication of delinquency, particularly a drug-related one, and that under the circumstances of this case, it was more appropriate to have an informal disposition, in this case being not consent decree, but a deferred prosecution agreement. And so there's a different, there's many different decisions. One is there a technical violation of statute, and if there is, what the disposition? Then there's a second one about what's the best way to deal with that technical violation of statute. Should it be a deferred prosecution agreement? Should it be a consent decree? Should it be a juvenile court disposition? And if so, which one? Justice Prosser asked about waiver hearings. I think that was very interesting because this decision, I think, is like a waiver hearing in a way because it's a decision as to what forum is the appropriate forum to hear the charges. It's not whether the charges are true or not. We don't have a decision about whether the child belongs in custody or not. That's a separate decision. The question is, what is the best forum for dealing with this conduct? And there is a requirement, by the way, that it have at least probable cause to show that there's a violation. So the judges, and also, again, the other analysis to the other, I think, analogy to waiver hearings is that in waiver, like in this case, the judge weighs the interests of the child and the public to determine which is the appropriate forum for the case, the juvenile court or the adult court.
Now, what about Ms. Wellman's argument that if you just drop this into the lap of the intake worker, there is no meaningful review? There is if there's notice of a violation, but otherwise can fall through cracks. There's no checks and balances there.
I absolutely disagree with that, and I would point to sections 938.06 and 938.067 of the statutes, as well as I think it's 938.245. I'll find you the subsection. 9. And I think this is related to a question that Justice Crooks asked earlier about the broader role of the judge in the juvenile court. Those statutes all state, and actually 938.245, parens 1, I believe, or 938.24, parens 1, that the intake worker works for the court. That initial intake worker inquiry is on behalf of the court. The intake worker's decision about deferred prosecution agreements or closing cases is governed by the policies set forth by the court under general written policies, which the judge shall promulgate under Section 938.06. And so this code, like its predecessor, assumes that the judge sets policies for the intake workers. What the Court of Appeals interpretation of these statutes results in is that the district attorney is not overseeing the deferred prosecution agreement, but the court is. And the court is doing that with its authority and supervisory authority and its intake policies governing court intake workers who are working on behalf of the court. I would cite the case, this court as well, to the case of In Re J.A., a 1987, I think it's a Court of Appeals case, it might be this court, in which the question was whether the judge could, under the current children's code then, require dispositional workers to prepare reports on foster care, how many foster homes were available and various statistics and information and placement, things about placement of kids in foster care. The district or the Department of Social Services challenged that, saying it's a violation of the separation of powers. And the court held that in the juvenile court, the judge oversees these dispositional options just as the judge oversees the intake options. And so the supervision of these deferred prosecution agreements is done by the court. And I do not agree that these go into space. It just means that the district attorney does not control that supervision agreement, the deferred prosecution agreement.
Could you clarify for me, is it possible for the juvenile court to dismiss and move a child into a deferred prosecution before the district attorney has the opportunity to request a waiver?
You know, I looked at the statute when you asked that question earlier, and what the waiver statute says is that a waiver is brought on by the filing of a delinquency petition and a waiver petition. And then it says the waiver petition has to be filed before the plea hearing. In almost every case,
before the
plea hearing. In almost every case, and I review these regularly, they're filed the same day, same time. Occasionally, the district attorney will say, I intend to file a waiver petition, or I'm considering filing a waiver petition, and I will make that, and they schedule cases so that the district attorney has the ability to make that. I don't think it's possible for the court to ambush the district attorney, because this is a motion that requires a hearing. And the judge has to make a finding as to the best interests of the child and the public. And so if the judge says, I'm going to consider whether to send this back to deferred prosecution now, and doesn't give the district attorney the ability to have some input into that decision, then I think that's a misuse of discretion under any standard that the court uses to review. That's a procedural due process question.
What sort of offenses are waivable?
Very
serious ones.
Well, any offense, just let me check the language, it's in 938.18.
The point of my question is that the offenses that are waivable are not likely to be offenses in which a judge is going to consider a deferred prosecution.
That's correct. I agree with that, too, although I do point out that it's for anybody 15 or older, it's any criminal law. But you're right. These are really the parades of horribles and the possibilities. You know, I think this case is a wonderful record of what happens, which is that there's a motion by the juvenile to dismiss the petition and refer it back for intake. The judge has a hearing. The intake worker has input. The DA has input. The juvenile has input. The parents have input. There was actually a proposed deferred prosecution agreement brought to court. And I think that in the real world, judges are not simply going to flip the back of their hands and say these go to deferred prosecution. They're going to want to see what people have to say about that. Is that a good option or not? And if they don't, I mean, one of the arguments that I just am so amazed about in the state's brief is they say the purpose of this statute, Section 938.21, parent 7, is to let the judge just send this back when he doesn't have, or he or she doesn't have enough information for further intake, inquiry, and review, and a possible negotiation of a deferred prosecution agreement. I can cite that in the brief because I think it's so surprising. This statute doesn't say that if the judge finds that further intake inquiry is appropriate, they refer it back to intake. The statute says the judge has to determine the best interests of the child and the public in terms of what forum this case should be decided in. That decision requires information. It requires analysis of the law as it relates to the facts of the case. And the judge couldn't just say, I don't know enough about this case, and so I'm going to find it's in the best interest of the child and the public to have it settled by a deferred prosecution agreement. I mean, to me, that is per se an abuse of discretion because the judge simply doesn't have the facts on which the judge can determine the best interest of the child and the public.
Do you know or have any sense of how frequently these motions are made under 93821 sub 7 in cases that are not in the custody pipeline?
Well, I mean, the truth is I think they're almost always made in cases that are not in the custody pipeline. I mean, that's why I'm saying that it doesn't make common sense. I asked one of our attorneys, that this is off the record stuff, but I asked one of our attorneys in Milwaukee how often they do these cases, how often they bring these 93821 parent 7 motions. And she said they bring them regularly. And it's usually cases that are not custody cases where the intake worker has scheduled an intake review and the mom or dad or somebody doesn't come. And then the petition is filed, they go to court, mom or dad comes, they sit down, they review it, and they decide that this can be handled with a deferred prosecution agreement. And that is the most common, and she said they do them very frequently in Milwaukee.
Typically then the DA is not objecting. It sounds like what you're describing.
Yeah, and I didn't ask her that specific question, so I can't tell you that. I do know that in other parts of the state I've heard off and on about cases that are contested by the district attorney, but every case I've ever heard of has not been a custody case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. Ms. Wellman, do you think your argument here is different than your brief, which mentioned custody frequently, and I think the only one that mentioned custody here was one of the justices?
No, we did not intend to abandon our custody argument. We just thought that that was addressed in the brief and is the more straightforward of the arguments, that we wouldn't try to use our argument time to address it. I think the only thing that may be a little different is I think when we got it, what we intended to say and what we intend to say is that they're separable arguments. If we lose on the custody argument, and this court says no, a court can do a 93821 sub 7 dismissal whether the child is in custody or not, then we believe that the standalone argument is that the prosecutor can then terminate that by filing a delinquency petition. Sometimes in our argument, we kept tying that back to custody, and we didn't mean that to mean that we rise and fall totally on the custody argument.
Because I thought there was a line in your brief that said, assuming that you won on argument one, then.
Right, and that we did not mean it to be that. Okay. If we lose argument one, we're done. The argument that we're making today is addressed in our brief. I guess we never use the term talking about incorporation by reference, but I just find it such a handy shorthand way to talk about it. But we do address our statutory construction argument and what's wrong with the Court of Appeals decision at pages 17 to 22 of our brief. Justice Crooks asked a question about mootness. And we feel, too, that this court should go ahead and decide this case because we do have a published decision. And if it's wrong, as we believe it is, it should be corrected. And I also think that outside of the juvenile context, the statutory interpretation methodology the Court of Appeals used is going to be a big problem for other statutory construction cases, because what it says is when one statute one incorporates statute two, Statute 2 incorporates Statute 3, but because Statute 1 didn't incorporate both 2 and 3, then 3 doesn't apply. That is just, I think that will create huge problems if it's not corrected.
Counsel, One of my concerns is the nature of the juvenile that is generally in these custody hearings. Now, I'm not talking about a CHIPS hearing that's taken place in an emergency capacity, but rather in a delinquency action. Typically, those cases are brought in on an emergency. That is, you have a 24-hour time, and so you're trying to fit them in. Typically, those kids, with regard to delinquency, are either on the run, and it's been picked up, and they're holding them in custody, and now are going to bring them before the court for a custody hearing, or have just been involved, picked up for some crime. Kids picked up for burglary, and they finally apprehended them and brought them in. Those kinds of situations where a kid is on the run, a kid is involved in a relatively serious crime, are not susceptible to these mamsy-pamsy deferred prosecution agreements. I mean, they're just, it's an anomaly. I don't think I would take a kid who has been picked up on suspicion of burglary and they're brought in generally, you know, with shackles, but, you know, undone at the counsel table, and send that kid to a deferred prosecution agreement to make sure he, you know, goes to school. I mean, these are, and that's the argument your opposing counsel makes, that it's kind of absurd to apply this in the type of cases that are least susceptible to it. Can you address that, please?
Well, I think if you only look at the nature at the child who, juvenile who is in custody because of the nature of the delinquent act or the crime, then that's probably largely true. Probably few, if any, of those juveniles are appropriate for deferred prosecution. But sometimes juveniles are also in custody because they are on the run, but what's really wrong is not so much the kid's behavior as the whole family situation, and that could be possibly, maybe there's some abuse going on, maybe we do need to intervene in this family. That might be appropriate for deferred prosecution.
But isn't it deferred prosecution only for in-home placement? So if a kid's on the run because of abuse in at home, ooh.
Well, maybe not abuse of bad parenting or a situation where, you know, things are just broken down, there's no communication, kids run, and the whole family really can be worked with. And so the child would return to the home and stay in the home. I think it's not likely, but it's not often that a court ought to be dismissing a delinquency petition and referring back for intake. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman, and thank you, Ms. Hirsch, for your argument on 9/38/21-7. And that closes the hearing on 01-0081 in the interest of Lindsay A.F., State v. Lindsay A.F. The court's in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:40.